Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Ellen Lockyer. This week, we'll be taking a look at some of the highlights in news coverage in Alaska news during 2015. We've seen a new state administration take the reins, now faced with economic challenges spurred by an unprecedented drop in oil prices. We've simultaneously made advances toward making an Alaska natural gas line a reality, although that prospect is still way over the horizon. We received an historic visit from the President of the United States, the first by a sitting president, and we got a sharp wake-up call as to how the environment is changing when wildfires threatened Kenai Peninsula communities and ripped through homes in Willow, north of Anchorage. We'll see how these fires and the President's visit are linked in a moment, but first, let's introduce our guests. Laura Phillips is an ecologist with the National Park Service in Fairbanks. Hello, Laura.
Hi.
And State Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry, Wildland Fire Program Manager, Tom Kurth. He took charge of fighting the Sockeye Fire in Willow as incident commander for the fire response. Hello, Tom.
Ellen.
Hi. And these two last events I mentioned, the president's visit and the wildfires, both in Kenai and in Willow, are linked. We will find out in a moment how. The Sockeye Fire, which erupted in mid-June in near Willow, it spread to over 7,200 acres. It devastated forest and it took 55 homes, all of them within that area. Extremely dry conditions and a very snowless winter the previous winter and a very, very long and very dry spring helped to fuel those flames. It was a combination of occurrences. And in August, President Obama, he went to Seward and he hiked the Exit Glacier with the Washington Press Corps in tow to highlight the shrinking glaciers in Alaska. After that, the president traveled to Kotzebue to view firsthand the impact of climate change on indigenous peoples. You may have seen President Obama's visit to the Exit Glacier on television last night as part of a reality show. And according to the White House press release, President Obama traveled to Alaska to shine a spotlight on the Alaskans in particular who have come to know that climate change is one of the biggest threats we face, and it is being driven by human activity, and it is disrupting American lives right now. The president's visit to Seward and to Kotzebue was aimed at drawing attention to the U.S. position on climate change as the year wound down to the United Nations Climate Summit in Paris, which wrapped up earlier this month. So what does this all mean for Alaskans here at home? Laura, can you outline some of the changes the National Park Service is noting in federal lands in Alaska?
Well, as you mentioned, you know, indigenous people, a lot of the rural residents have been using the landscape for a long time, including parklands and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuge lands. And we hear a lot of anecdotal evidence, you know, traditional knowledge coming from our rural residents about the changes they see on the landscape, about how much harder it is to hunt and fish and to access their sort of the historic areas that they used to go hunt caribou, with rivers being open later in the fall, proving, you know, safety hazards. We're seeing increased permafrost thaw, which is affecting facilities and roads and our infrastructure. We're also seeing increased shrubs encroaching in elevation, and then also in a lot of areas that we didn't have them before on the tundra. Increased wildfire, as you mentioned. So there's kind of a host of different impacts that we're seeing on the landscape currently.
Right. That permafrost thaw you just mentioned is being seen in, I think, five different parks, Gates of the Arctic, the Bering Sea Bridge. And it was recently mentioned, or I guess a paper was given in San Francisco at a scientific meeting not too long ago. There's like something like 20 million acres of national park in Alaska. Is that or effects?
National parkland is permafrost. You know, we have 54 million acres, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of which is permafrost. So anywhere from Denali north, you know, you've got discontinuous to continuous permafrost on parklands. You know, in Denali, we see effects to the park road with landslides and slumping, a lot of energy and effort, and also safety risks associated with that. Further north, you're going to see an increase in mercury release into the atmosphere, along with associated vegetation changes, draining of small thaw lakes. It's changing fairly dramatically, and seeing those permafrost slumps and sort of physical changes on the landscape are very diagnostic of that.
Right. Well, what kind of safety concerns does this bring? I mean, obviously infrastructure would be impacted, but say what about the regular tourist who would be wanting to go to the gates of the Arctic, or how would they be impacted by, say, melting permafrost?
Yeah, melting permafrost, that's a tough one. You know, it really is, the place that we're seeing it most was with landslides and floods in Denali National Park along the road, where we have a large number of tourists. Gates, you're going to get the type of tourist that goes there generally is a fairly hardy backcountry person. You're going to see probably with increased snow melt and glacial melt in the summer, higher rivers, more increase for challenging river crossings and that sort of thing.
So have you noticed, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, just released its 2015 Arctic report card, and it's saying that the Arctic is warmer now than it has been since 1900. Mm-hmm. So do you see that this maybe more benign climate from a human perspective is attracting a different type of tourist, or tourists for a different reason?
I don't think so. Okay. You know, I don't think that's our impression. I think there's still a lot of education that needs to happen, nationwide on climate change, on what's happening in the Arctic and in Alaska. I think it's starting to trickle out, and with the president's visit highlighting it, that really helps us a lot to get the message out, but there's a lot more that we could do. And, the Park Service, because we do have a great interpretive tool, we have staff that can help with science communication. I feel like, especially in Alaska, our staff has done a really great job on interpreting climate change and trying to get that to the visitors.
Right. Well, I think anyone who's been in Alaska a while can remember when you could view the Portage Glacier right from the little parking lot in front of the Forest Service Interpretive Center there. Now you have to take a boat to see it. You can't see it at all unless you get on this boat and travel. So I would ask you one more. Winter. People who maybe do not live in Alaska will say, well, what's the big deal? It's warmer now. Isn't that great? But some people need winter, some animals need winter.
Yeah, it's hard on the wildlife, You look at icing events, we've got a large decrease in our adult sheep population, especially in northwestern Alaska, because we're getting these weather events and these icing events that prevent them from being able to access their forage in the winter, causing starvation and pretty rapid declines the last few years in the sheep populations there. So if that's something that's increasing over time, we could see pretty big impacts to these species that are well adapted to the environment as it is now.
Right. Well, NOAA's report card also indicated that a warmer stream of air from the North Pacific swept through Alaska from November of 2014 through the early part of 2015. And the warm air helped to create conditions that tripped the state's second biggest year as far as wildfires are concerned. So Tom Kurth, you were the incident commander fighting the Sockeye Fire north of Willow. Can you tell us a little bit about the background? What fueled that fire?
Well, typically with a lot of our fires, there's several components that are involved. One is the ground layer where our duff is, and that's a very thick mat of organic material that can be sometimes 6 inches to 24 inches. That tends to hold and harbor a fire. Then above that is our brush layer of alder and willow and Labrador tea and associated species that will also carry a fire. And then finally above that is our black spruce, which is a very volatile species and certainly prone to fire. And in the sockeye fire, once you get that wind component behind it, that black spruce is carrying a crown fire and spotting ahead of itself. So it's throwing out embers out there, you know, a quarter mile ahead of itself and then burning back into the main fire. So the black spruce is the primary carrier of our fastest moving, most dangerous fires. And that was the case once it got established there in the sockeye fire.
Is black spruce more oily or something? Or
well, it does have a tannin component to it, like turpentine, and it's certainly volatile. It's even fire dependent to open its cones up, and so the boreal forest, primarily north of the Alaska Range, all the way from our western boundary, all the way through Canada and down to the lower 48, the boreal forest is very prone to fire. And lightning is a big component to get those fires started. And so if you were to look at a map of the boreal forest, you'd see hundreds of fires that have been occurring through the past few decades here.
Mm-hmm. So the wind coupled with the extremely dry conditions were two undeniable factors in the spread of the fire. So what are the greatest challenges in fighting a fire of that nature, one that is, you know, so close to human habitation?
Well, yeah, and this fire had the very warm and dry May that tended to dry out all the fuel that was located in that area there. And then once June rolled around, it's prepped and ready for fire. And then it was unfortunately caused by careless human activity. And that wind is behind it and certainly moves those fires through, in this case, in the Willow area, it's the urban interface, or at least there are structures and subdivisions out there. And so, as a wildland firefighter, our initial attack forces, when they go in there, sort of have to make a decision, you know, are they going to spend their time evacuating and protecting homes, or are they going to try and contain the fire's perimeter? And oftentimes in an urban interface fire, it kind of becomes a defensive mode where you're spending time making sure that people are evacuating and getting their belongings and getting out in timely fashion and have at least a route selected to get them out, and then protecting homes as this fire moves through there. It kind of becomes almost a retreat and return sort of strategy. So the fire moves through and the firefighting forces can come and make sure that this isn't spreading to the homes. And then once they get that strategy established, they can oftentimes move, let's say, when evening comes around to try and contain the fire itself along the perimeter. But the urban interface fire offers us a different environment where, you know, minutes are counting and we have to make sure we're protecting as much people and property as we can out there.
Right. As a reporter, I talked to people the following Monday morning who had literally had 15 minutes or less to evacuate and moved that fast. So people should be aware that this is not the kind of thing you can spot a few miles away and take your time getting out. When you say perimeter, how does that work? Do they section off sections of the fire and create a block for its spread? Or?
Well, and again, on initial attack, locating where that perimeter is, you're trying to anchor someplace so the firefighter's safety is a priority. Mm-hmm. You establish an anchor point, and then you try and flank the fire and stay along the active edge there, and then eventually corral the thing, pinch it off, and contain it that way. In the case of the sockeye, out at the head of the fire might be our retardant chips or our helicopter buckets or something trying to knock out that forward movement while we're trying to catch up back at the anchor point and doing the flanking. So that's a pretty typical strategy there. And then again, in between there, you might do structure protection to make sure these fires, sometimes these fires will pass through a subdivision without taking out the homes. And then the creeping fire might come back and find a wood pile or come underneath the home or something and rekindle something like that. So Both of those are a threat to any homeowner there. And in the Sockeye fire, there were actually 55 homes lost and at least 44 damaged out there. So it was a fairly large structure loss. And in the area where the Miller's Reach fire from some time ago took out over 300 structures. So the potential for a property loss is large out there with the wildland environment that we have.
It's huge. I remember the Miller's Reach fire. I was going to ask you, were lives lost? Were there injuries in the Sockeye?
There were no lives lost, which is always what we consider our number one success out there. And firefighting is inherently risky, so there are firefighter injuries that occur out there. There might be Pulaski injuries or falling trees, but nothing of the nature where we lost time out there with firefighters.
What kind of state resources does it take to fight a fire of that nature?
Well,
manpower.
Sure.
Money.
I mean, it takes individual overhead, which is the supervision. It takes crews, which are hot shots and type 2 initial attack crews, and our type 2 crews, which are often from our rural areas. In a case of a Sockeye fire, it might be 500 to 700 people that we're utilizing. It takes helicopters to move and use for bucket work. It takes aerial supervision, so we have our air attack ships circling overhead to tell us where the fire is moving to and what strategies we might take. And then retardant ships are trying to knock the forward movement out of these fires. And then we're using local fire departments to help protect structures out there, so they're all combined in a unified command sort of oversight for the whole thing. So they're very labor intensive out there. So at one time, there's liable to be the number that we mentioned there, 500, 700 people at one time out there. So it's a large effort.
How does it work? I know crews were brought in from other states.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That is part of the federal structure, or how does that work?
Well, we're all part of an interagency effort that is structured from the standpoint you have geographical centers that do the coordination. They might be in any place from Fairbanks to Portland, Atlanta, Milwaukee, and then the central part of that is in Boise. So when we're shorthanded, we put in our need for help through the Boise Interagency Center. That goes out to the geographical centers, and they're trying to locate who's available and what help we might use. Now, we also have a very close relationship with the Canadian government, so that includes all the provinces. We get a lot of help from British Columbia. Our retardant ships are from there. They can supplement our retardant help sometimes in less than 12 hours, and so Alberta, Saskatchewan, those places are helping us out. And then our western states are also in another close agreement, so sometimes we can shorten the time to get them up if we have to.
So how long did it take to contain the Sockeye fire and finally declare it to be out?
Well, the Sockeye fire originally started on a Sunday afternoon, again with a big wind component, and then most of the damage is done within that first 24 to 48 hour period. That's why Urban Interface fires, wildland fires, we're often talking minutes to try and respond to these. And then the local initial attack group out of the Anchorage Mat-Su area, the local fire departments, whether it be Willow or the Central Emergency Services, and all the local fire departments are combined in that effort there. And the forward movement of that fire was knocked out in about 48 hours. And then a lot of the labor-intensive work of making sure all the smokes are out and trying to put the fire out completely takes another, it might be 2 weeks, a month, and then folks around from the Palmer office are out there to respond when a smoke pops up, because again, that duff layer, it's very thick, and it can be rained on, it'll hold a fire underneath there. And those things start popping up maybe throughout the summer. So they were taking care of those a month later, at least 6 weeks later. Yeah.
And at the same time, almost simultaneously, another huge fire broke out down on the Kenai Peninsula, the Card Fire, I believe. How does that put stress on the state's firefighting resources?
Well, we have the Alaska Interagency Coordination Center located in Fairbanks. So each and every day, the fire suppression agencies, primarily the Alaska Fire Service, which is the Bureau of Land Management, and the state of Alaska, U.S. Forest Service. They're meeting there on a daily basis to figure out where we might distribute our resources for the day. It's primary tactical resources. That might be smoke jumpers, it might be retardant ships, helicopters, that sort of thing. So we use those collectively in this initial attack effort. So they are there to, let's say, respond to the sockeye fire initially. And that's where the effort and the emphasis is. Then the card fire breaks out the next day or something. Those resources that we were using, because our threat has been mitigated somehow, are then moved over to the Card Street fire so that they can be used in a collective effort down in that location. And then we start prioritizing who gets what. And it's really, if it's a moving fire in the interface, that's going to be our number one priority. So we might have to prioritize those things. And when you get multiple fires, that's when you have your biggest problems, especially if the wind is blowing and these fires are moving on us. That's when the excitement truly is right there.
So is there a cost estimate yet on the sockeye fire, what the response?
Yeah, the sockeye fire was somewhere over $8 million, around 8.3, something like that. We're still tallying all that up. Again, it's labor intensive, so the firefighting is big business. And it can be expensive. You also have to weigh that over all the values that are protected, though. And that can be in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars in homes and infrastructure that's out there. And that can be power lines, communication sites, subdivisions, commercial sites, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I just checked with the borough the other day. They still don't have a tally on the cost to homeowners and insurance companies and losses, and they're working on that. In fact, just the other day, the borough assembly did honor the 14 people from this volunteer task force that is helping Willow residents recover, you know, by helping them rebuild, helping them get the things they need.
Right.
So just one more for you. How many fires did the state have to fight this year?
Well, collectively, there were 766 fires throughout the state. We had our second largest fire year on record regarding acreage. That was 5.144 million. So that's a lot of fires. It's interesting to note that some of our biggest fire years, our biggest, again, on record was in 2004. But, four or five of our biggest fire years have occurred in the last 11 years or so. So the problem is certainly getting bigger and more challenging. It's this particular fire season is somewhat noteworthy. From a seven-day period, we had over 60,000 lightning strikes across the state in one seven-day period. And I think we had almost 300 fire starts come out of that particular lightning storm. So that's the scale and scope that we're in here in the land of extremes.
Wow. We have a map of the fires between 2004 and 2015, comparing them.
Right.
It's up on the screen. Great. Mm-hmm. So the fires, when you look a little closer to the map, it looks like they're moving to the west of Alaska. Is that true?
Well, I just wouldn't draw any conclusions from picking 2 years out. In 2004, it was a similar situation. We had a lot of lightning starts. We did have a lot of fires that were in close proximity to communities. That included Fairbanks, Delta, Tok. Those were very dangerous fires there and encroach on those communities. And so they certainly take a lot of effort to try and keep those up into the wildlands. Then in 2015, this last go around here, a lot of that occurred in the central and western interior from lightning storms that occurred out there. And if you can string together a few days of hot and dry weather and then follow it up with a dry lightning storm, you're going to have fires in those areas there. And that's just an occurrence that we had, but it can occur in any part of the state. So again, principally north of the Alaska Range where the boreal forests are, and the two get tied together and make for a big fire season.
Wow, thank you, Tom. Well, let's recap a little bit some of the other stories related to melting glaciers. The Matanuska Glacier certainly melted into the river and caused some flooding in Sutton this summer, and that was again due to our very dry and very early spring and extremely warm April, May, and June. And I just read recently that visitorship to the Mendenhall Glacier down in Juneau is up almost three times the number of tour applicants have contacted the Park Service there to get permits to bring in tourists because they want to see melting glaciers now. That's why I asked you that question earlier. And before they're gone, and torrential rains in Sitka this summer caused a landslide that tragically took 3 lives. So there are a lot of dangers that are associated with climate warming that we haven't really calculated yet. I wanted to get back to the permafrost.
It's geohazards in general are something that the Park Service is starting to spend a lot more time monitoring, a lot more money on. You've got glacial outburst floods. Kenai Fjords has a small lake that will have an outburst flood occasionally, and we're seeing that with other glaciers. So there can be a flooding event and tourists might, be recreating in the area, and so that becomes a problem. We also see, active calving glaciers, so you're going to see, potentially more tide events.
Right. Thanks, Laura. We're running out of time for Alaska Edition, and so that is all the time we have. I would like to thank my guests, Laura Phillips and Tom Kurth, and remember that we're taking a couple of weeks off for the holidays, so we will see you again in January.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.